Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Winters in the World, A Journey Through the Anglo-Saxon Year, by Eleanor Parker, narrated by Jennifer M. Dixon. Preface. This book is a guide and introduction to the Anglo-Saxon year, and my hope is that it will also serve as an introduction to the immensely rich and creative literature of Anglo-Saxon England, a treasury of poetry and thought, profoundly rewarding to explore, but not easy for many people to access today. Quotations and references have all been chosen with this purpose in mind, prioritizing what will be most useful for the general listener. Unless otherwise noted, all translations are my own. A famous preface from Anglo-Saxon literature, introducing one of the books which formed part of Alfred the Great's programme for rebuilding education among the English in the late 9th century, compares the act of translation to going into the woods to collect timber, gathering materials for building, and coming back laden with branches. The translator collected as much as he could carry from the original text, he says, but still wished he could have brought more. In every tree I saw something I needed at home. So he recommends every reader to go to the woods, the forest of books, and gather for themselves. I advise everyone who is able, and has many wagons, to make his way to that same wood where I cut these posts, and gather more for himself, and load up his wagons with fine timbers, so that he may weave many elegant walls, and establish many a noble house, and build a fine homestead, and there dwell in happiness and peace, both summer and winter. I've tried to make it possible for every listener of this book to do the same. Introduction. The Anglo-Saxon Year. Winter is coldest, spring frostiest, it is longest cold, summer sun brightest, the sun is hottest, harvest most glory blessed, it brings to men the year's fruits which God sends them. These lines are from an Anglo-Saxon poem called Maxims 2, sketching a word portrait of the cycle of the year. The four seasons are given the very briefest of descriptions, and each has one superlative, summing up its essential characteristic in a single word. Though they might sound like obvious statements, they're not as straightforward as they seem. The cold of winter, the brightness of summer, the abundance of autumn— all immediately make sense. But is frostiest really the first thing that leaps to mind when you think of spring, the season of daffodils, blossom, and baby lambs? Perhaps not. These lines offer a picture of a cycle we know by heart, and even some familiar words. Winter, summer, sun. But this is not quite our year, and the round of seasons this poet knew was both like and unlike our own. In this book, we'll explore how poets, like the anonymous author of Maxims 2, and the writers of other works from Anglo-Saxon England, histories, scientific texts, sermons, and many more, thought about the cycle of the seasons. We'll discuss the festivals and traditions they associated with particular times of year, considering how the changing seasons affected patterns of work and religious custom, as well as investigating the language these English writers used to describe their experience of the year. The six centuries we today call the Anglo-Saxon period, 600 summers and winters, were a formative time for English society, in which many things first took shape which, after the passage of centuries, are still to some degree recognisable as those the Anglo-Saxons knew. The English language, the settlement and naming of most of our cities, towns and villages, the monarchy, the national church, and England itself. Among the most enduring aspects of English life that evolved in the Anglo-Saxon period was the cycle of the year that we'll be exploring in this book. Through the four seasons described by Maxims 2, weaving in and out of the circling months, there developed a yearly round of feasts and festivals, celebrations and customs, which still forms the basis of our own seasonal cycle. Christmas and Easter, Candlemas and Whitsun, Michaelmas, Lent and Lammas, all these first began to be celebrated in this country during the Anglo-Saxon period, and owe their names to the Anglo-Saxons. The later Middle Ages added more festivals to the calendar, the Reformation swept many away, but through more than 1,000 years of religious, political and social upheaval, the basic pattern of the festival year remained a stable part of life. Well into the 20th century, it provided the shared cycle of high days and holidays, as well as all the common waymarkers in the agricultural, legal and educational year. Over the past 100 years, it has grown increasingly unfamiliar. Many of us have lost touch with the agricultural calendars that determined these cycles of feast and fast, and in modern secular Britain, we now celebrate a wide and diverse range of festivals alongside these older feasts. Even if the calendar is changing, though, our year is still shaped by the rhythms of the seasons, and as we go on our journey through the Anglo-Saxon year, we'll encounter some familiar sights. Poets finding ways to capture in words the beauty of glittering ice, blossom and birdsong, green summer meadows or the falling leaves of autumn. There are also aspects of their year which can seem strange to modern eyes, and intriguingly so. We'll hear writers imagining the calendar imbued with divine power, as if time itself can be sacred. We'll hear them explaining the close kinship between humans and the natural world, recognizing our own experiences of growth and decay reflected in the cycles of the sun and moon and the waxing and waning of plants and trees. We'll explore an understanding of the world in which human life, as lived through the seasons, was one part of an organic whole, inseparable from the patterns of nature, where the natural, the human, and the holy were interrelated in the most essential ways. The months of the English. Let's start by thinking about time. In modern Britain, the calendar in most widespread use is the Gregorian calendar, which, though devised in the late 16th century, has its origins in the Julian calendar, used in the Roman Empire. It's a solar calendar, following the cycle of the sun rather than the moon, and it has 12 months, whose names in modern English also derive ultimately from the Latin month names of the Roman calendar. We have 4 seasons in a year, though ideas about when they begin vary. While the Gregorian calendar is our common standard, though, many people live simultaneously according to other calendars too, different religious calendars, solar and lunar, which determine the dates of fasts and festivals, the calendars that structure school and university terms, the legal calendar, the tax year. Even the football season has a fixed calendar by which many people track the passage of time. All this may seem self-evident, but as we'll learn, the seasons of the Anglo-Saxon year don't map directly onto any modern pattern, so it's helpful to start by recognizing that our own calendar is a human construction, like any other, and not the only or the obvious way to organize the passage of time. When considering Anglo-Saxon England, we should also think of a diversity of calendars used by different groups in society for varying purposes. Farmers and monks, kings and labourers would all have experienced the seasons in different ways, depending on the patterns of work that gave shape to their months and years. Nonetheless, there were some calendars that affected everyone. In the Middle Ages, the agricultural year was much more fundamental to most people's lives than it is today, and some awareness of it would have been general. Even kings had to know how the harvest was going and order their plans by it. At times, when labourers were needed for the harvest, they weren't available to fight in their king's wars. For the majority of the Anglo-Saxon period, the liturgical year of the Christian calendar was also observed by society in common. Everyone kept the same seasons of fasting or observed religious holidays at the same time, since these dates were not a matter of personal choice, but enforced by royal decree. When we talk about the agricultural and church calendars in a medieval context, we are talking about communal structures of time that were shared across society. Agricultural cycles were a constant, but when it came to the religious calendar, the Anglo-Saxon period witnessed a radical shift in the reckoning of time. At the start of this period in the 5th century, the peoples of Anglo-Saxon England were predominantly pagan. Over the course of the 7th century, they converted to Christianity, and with the new religion came an entirely new calendar. All our surviving written sources on this subject date from after the conversion, so it's difficult to get a clear picture of what the structure of the year might have been like beforehand. For that, we're largely dependent on one important source, a short chapter in a work by the Anglo-Saxon historian Bede. Around 725, Bede wrote a book called De Temporum Ratione, The Reckoning of Time, a learned discussion of the calendar and the principles by which time was calculated in the medieval church. In the early Middle Ages, this was the science of computus, a source of endless fascination to mathematically minded medieval scholars. Computus was important because it taught you how to calculate the date of Easter, crucial for working out the dates of other key festivals in the church year. But there were many other aspects to this study too. It involved understanding the cycles of the moon, calculating leap years, knowing the proper dates of the months, seasons, equinoxes, and solstices, and measuring periods of time from the briefest to the longest, the instant to the aeon. All these topics are explored in Bede's De Temporum Ratione. One purpose of his text is to explain that there are many different ways of reckoning these things across different cultures. His discussion shows that calendars are the product of convention and human reasoning, so they're culturally determined and prone to change, error, and correction. But for Bede, as for other medieval scholars, the study of time was not just a human science, but a sacred pursuit. In their eyes, the structure of the year reflected profound truths about the nature of the universe, planned and created by God, which found expression in every detail of the calendar. Time was part of God's creation. To study it was to learn something about the mind of its divine creator. In discussing the year's structure in different cultures, Bede lists the month names of the Hebrew, Roman, Greek, and Egyptian calendars and adds a brief chapter about the months of the English in ancient times, before the Anglo-Saxon conversion to Christianity. "It did not seem fitting," he says, "that I should speak of other nations' observance of the year and yet be silent about my own." What he tells us about the pre-conversion calendar is a tiny part of a lengthy work, and it doesn't take long to summarise. Before the conversion, he suggests the Anglo-Saxons used a lunisolar calendar and divided the year into two seasons, summer and winter. Winter began on the full moon of the month roughly equivalent to October in the Julian calendar, which for this reason was called Winterfilleth. The 2 months around each solstice shared a name, suggesting that these were important turning points of the year, and Bede says that the year began on the 25th of December, that is, probably the winter solstice, which was called Modranicht, Mother's Night. He then lists the names of the months in English and offers an explanation for each name. As the calendar was lunisolar, these wouldn't be exactly equivalent with the months in the Julian calendar, to which Bede matches them, but from his information we can construct a list. Latin month, December and January. English name, Iola. Bede's interpretation, named after the winter solstice. Latin month, February. English name, Solmanath. Bede's interpretation, month of cakes, which they offered to their gods in that month. Latin month, March. English name, Hrethmanath. Bede's interpretation, named for a goddess, Hretha, to whom they sacrificed at this time. Latin month, April. English name, Eostemonath. Bede's interpretation, named for a goddess, Eostre, in whose honour feasts were celebrated in that month. Latin month, May. English name, Thrimilche. Bede's interpretation, because in that month cattle were milked three times a day. Latin month, June and July. English name, Litha. Bede's interpretation, gentle or navigable, because calm weather made these months good for sailing. Latin month, August. English name, Weodmonath. Bede's interpretation, month of weeds, because they are very plentiful then. Latin month, September. English name, Halimonath. Bede's interpretation, month of sacred rites. Latin month, October. English name, Winterfileth. Bede's interpretation, because winter began on the full moon of this month. Latin month, November. English name, Blotmonath. Bede's interpretation, month of sacrifices, because cattle slaughtered then were consecrated to the gods. We'll explore the names he provides in more detail as we go on. Some of Bede's suggested etymologies are convincing, but others, as we'll learn, have been challenged by modern scholars. Most likely, Bede wasn't relying on personal knowledge, but was using a written source for the month names and adding his own speculations about their meaning, and in some cases he may just have been guessing. This means that although this is a very useful and interesting list, it has to be taken with some caution. These names don't seem to have been in widespread use in Anglo-Saxon England, at least after the 7th century. Bede implies they have already fallen out of use by the time he was writing, and in our surviving written sources they have been replaced, for most practical purposes, with the Latin month names from the Julian calendar. When writers do use the Old English names recorded by Bede, it's typically as a kind of scholarly curiosity. They appear alongside the Latin names in English calendars as late as the 12th century, sometimes with month names in Hebrew and Greek too, for those who really wanted to show off their calendrical learning. But the people who wrote those calendars were usually copying from Bede, so these sources don't tell us that the names were actually in general use in Anglo-Saxon England any more than the Hebrew and Greek ones were. What's more, though Bede presents this list as the months of the English, it's likely that there was originally a fair amount of diversity in month names rather than one unified system. Each region of Anglo-Saxon England, in Bede's day, a group of separate kingdoms, spoke its own dialect of Old English, and Bede's list may well record a system used in only one area. Some alternative Old English month names are recorded in other sources, including Hlida, March, Rugern, August, and Harfestmonath, September, which seem to have been in use in other parts of the country. We should conclude, perhaps, that Bede isn't describing to us the Anglo-Saxon year, but only one version of it, and there may have been other calendars of which we now have no record. Nonetheless, Bede's evidence is very helpful, since some aspects of the system he describes seem to have endured for centuries, long after the Anglo-Saxons adopted Christianity, and with it the Julian calendar. He appears to be right, for instance, when he says that the Anglo-Saxons originally had a two-season year, summer and winter, which was replaced with the four-season structure with which we are now familiar. This four-season pattern is used in a number of Anglo-Saxon texts, like Maxims 2, the poem with which we began, and where these specify dates for the seasons, the transition usually occurs roughly halfway between the solstices and the equinoxes. Winter starts on the 7th of November, spring on the 7th of February, summer on the 9th of May, and autumn on the 7th of August. This means that the solstices and equinoxes fall at the middle or height of each season, rather than, as often today, marking the beginning. Bede discusses alternative systems for dating the seasons in De Temporum Ratione, but recommends this structure, which he attributes to the Greeks and Romans. Following his lead, calendars in Anglo-Saxon manuscripts frequently use these dates to mark the beginnings of the seasons. Some poems employ this system too, especially those most influenced by Christian learning and the liturgical calendar. In other contexts, however, many Anglo-Saxon writers still seem to think in terms of a two-season year, with the solstices, often called midwinter and midsummer, falling halfway through each season. The dark, cold half of the year is universally called winter in Old English, and the other half-year may be called sumor, summer, or, more rarely, ir, the origin of our word year. Though year in Old English can simply mean year, as we would understand it, a period of 12 months, in poetry it often seems to have a more specialised meaning. The season of growth and light, including both spring and harvest, the whole warm half of the year. It's common in Old English to count time by winters, to speak, for instance, of someone having lived a certain number of winters in the world, and we'll notice that winter is a season which looms large in Anglo-Saxon poetry. The other season, sumor, was not so often used to measure time in this way, but ir was, and that's why we count time in years. In this two-season structure, what we'd think of as spring was part of summer, and the months we'd consider autumn fall partly at the end of summer, in harvest, partly in winter. This probably explains why words for spring and autumn have fluctuated much more in the history of English than the names for summer and winter. Though the words summer and winter go back to very similar Anglo-Saxon names, spring and autumn are much later additions to the language. In Old English, spring is called lengten, a word which derives from the same Germanic root as long and lengthen, denoting the season when the days are growing longer. After the conversion, lengthen also came to be used for the season of fasting before Easter, and so became the origin of the word Lent. Right through the Anglo-Saxon period and well into the 14th century, the word continued to have both meanings, the season of spring and the season of fasting, which of course always falls in spring. In the centuries after the Norman conquest, other alternatives also came into use, such as ver, borrowed into Middle English from French. It was only in the late medieval period that spring began to be used as a season name. Ver fell out of use, and Lent narrowed its meaning to refer only to the pre-Easter fast. Similarly, the word autumn, another borrowing from French, though like ver, ultimately deriving from Latin, only appeared in English at the end of the 14th century. Before that, the season was harfest, the origin of modern English harvest. With this season, too, there was variety in naming right through the later Middle Ages and the early modern period. Harvest persisted alongside autumn and another term, fall, first recorded in the mid-16th century. At the time when British and American English began to diverge, the alternatives autumn and fall predominated in the two varieties of the language and are still distinct today. Meanwhile, harvest, like Lent, survived, but in a more specialised sense than its Old English meaning. Gradually it came to mean not one of the four seasons of the year, but only the period when crops and fruits are gathered in. All this suggests that in popular understanding of the year, both these transitional seasons have been more fluid, while the core pairing of summer and winter remained basically unchanged. The older way of thinking about the seasonal pattern which Bede ascribes to the Anglo-Saxon calendar before the conversion to Christianity persisted for many centuries. A new religion and a new calendar. In most other ways, however, the calendar that arrived with the conversion set down firm roots in the English festival year. By the time the Anglo-Saxons converted to Christianity, the essential structure of the Christian liturgical calendar was already well established. It had developed as the product of a long process of negotiation and adjustment in the first centuries of the Church's history, in order to find a way of reconciling the Jewish calendar, crucial to dating festivals based in the gospel narratives of the life of Christ, with the calendars used in the Roman Empire and other parts of the Church. At the time of the Anglo-Saxon conversion, the most important aspects of this process were complete. Nonetheless, the calendar did not remain static, but continued to grow and develop as more feasts and observances were added, spreading through international networks of cultural exchange, in which the new Anglo-Saxon Church soon began to play its part. While Christianity might have been new to the Anglo-Saxons in the 7th century, it was not, of course, new to Britain. Present in Roman Britain in the 3rd and 4th centuries, after the departure of the Roman armies, it continued to flourish in Wales and other parts of Western Britain. It's likely that some form of Romano-British Christianity survived in England into the Anglo-Saxon period, though the evidence is patchy. British and Irish Christianity exerted an important influence in the early years of the Anglo-Saxon Church, especially in Northumbria, sometimes a controversial issue when it came to the calendar, as we'll discover later. Nonetheless, the foundational narrative of Anglo-Saxon Christianity, as told most influentially by Bede, gave the prominent role in the conversion to the mission that arrived in Kent in 597, sent from Rome by Pope Gregory I. Aethelbert, King of Kent, agreed to accept baptism and supported the establishment of a new church, and the mission's leader, Augustine, became the first Archbishop of Canterbury, Aethelbert's royal city. From Kent, Augustine and his companions sent missionaries to convert the other Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, where they met with a more mixed reception. During the 7th century, however, one region after another gradually adopted the new religion. In the early medieval period, religious conversion was frequently a collective rather than an individual process, and it marked a profound cultural shift. The introduction of a new shared festival calendar was an important part of this. In a letter of advice to the Augustinian mission, Gregory counseled them to treat conversion as a process of adaptation, telling them to offer the newly converted Anglo-Saxons Christian feasts in exchange for their existing festivals, and to repurpose the sites of pagan shrines as Christian churches. The idea was that it would be easier for people to accept the new religion if they were allowed to keep aspects of their old festivals. While some outward rejoicings are preserved, they will be able more easily to share in inward rejoicings, Gregory wrote. This was a tried and tested practice in the early Middle Ages, and one there was no attempt to hide. Medieval historians were well aware that the Church had frequently Christianized pagan festivals and customs, not only in the context of the Anglo-Saxon conversion, but, much more importantly, even in the eyes of medieval English historians, in Rome. Bede, for instance, explains how the custom of processing with candles at the Feast of the Purification of the Virgin Mary, the 2nd of February, was a Christianized version of a processional ritual of expiation observed in pagan Rome and adopted by the early church. Similar explanations are provided by Anglo-Saxon writers for the processions of Rogationtide, which we'll consider in detail later, and for the Ember Days, four periods of prayer and fasting corresponding to the four seasons of...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?